Welcome to the podcast. We're here today with Jesse Eisinger, who covers economics and finance for ProPublica. He's recently read Tim Geithner's book, Stress Test, and has found that it's not just another Washington memoir. Welcome, Jesse.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what did you find revealing in this book? I mean, these things usually have a certain form. The guy's heroic. Things work out in the end, but it's tough, but the right decisions were made. What was different about Geithner's book?
Well, you know, Geithner comes across as a kind of really humble guy. He's got no particular expertise. He's not a PhD economist. He's never been a Wall Street banker, contrary to all of his reputation. And he's thrown into these crises, crisis after crisis, and then he gets to the big one here. And it's a depiction of how he deals with it. And the real revealing thing is that he just tries to steer the center road for centrism's sake. And it's clearly what Obama prefers, that it's the Obama tone that he's reflecting.
In fact, Jesse, doesn't the book confirm something our own Jeff Gerth wrote about, which is that Geithner in his job at the New York Fed went light on Citibank?
Yes, it does. It's pretty devastating about his failures in general leading up to the crisis. The New York Fed was quintessentially captured regulator. Geithner walks through the appointees that he put on the board of the New York Fed, including Dick Fuld and other bankers, Jamie Dimon, Goldman Sachs people. He wants to bring in that kind of expertise, and they all say, well, the banks are okay, and Citigroup is the biggest failure of oversight on Geithner's watch. And Geithner was sort of tinkering around the edges of the problem, talking about systemic risk, but not really accomplishing it, which makes his subsequent failure to push more aggressive reform all the more puzzling, because he's lived through his own personal mistakes, seen the consequences of it, and the fact that he then doesn't turn to more ambitious reform is really disappointing.
Well, and in part, I suspect this is what led you to believe that perhaps an even greater force was behind the scenes here.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Geithner's background, because as you say, he's not an economist or an expert. He's not like Bernanke, who studied the Depression as an academic subject. So what did he do before this?
He falls into this. He's a guy who works in economic policy at the Treasury, and he becomes the point person on crises. He first deals with the Mexico peso crisis, which was called the tequila crisis, a little politically incorrect. Then he deals with the Thai baht crisis, the Russian default crisis, and he sort of works his way up through the technocratic firmament within Treasury, and then gets appointed, kind of against all odds, to be the president of the Fed, the New York Fed. And so he's become the guy who is good, in theory, at dealing with bailing out crises.
And of course, we had the mother of all crises arrive right at the moment that he's appointed.
Yes, yeah, so he's seemingly the perfect man for this. He deals with the first glimmers of the crisis when he's the president of the New York Fed, when it's Bernanke and Hank Paulson under the Bush administration, and then Obama appoints him to be the Treasury Secretary, and in a kind of nice, humble moment, which I believe was completely disingenuous, he explains in his book how he didn't want the Treasury job, that he was going to tie Obama to all the previous policies, which was exactly true. And I consider the Obama appointment of Geithner to be the single worst political mistake Obama made, simply for that reason, that they could have done everything that they wanted to do with the bailout, but not tied themselves politically to it if they had simply had different personnel.
Now, your suggestion here is that Obama, who's kind of off stage but very much a presence in the book, is really the guiding hand behind a series of things that we're now living with. Talk a little bit about that. What are those things?
Well, so the book is stirring up all this old anger about the bailout and the question of whether the bailout was too generous to the banks, about the housing policy, which we've covered a lot at ProPublica, Paul Keel has covered, and the disaster of not refinancing or modifying mortgages for desperate homeowners. Those are the two signature events of the Obama administration, and I think the housing policies are the signature failure. But what you get is a lot of criticism, and we've seen a lot of criticism of Geithner himself and pointing to him as the person that's failed. But in fact, the things that we criticize Geithner for turn out to have been replicated in other departments of the Obama administration, and the flaws continue post-Geithner. And suddenly, the realization is that this is not a Geithner problem. This is an Obama problem.
Well, let's be a little specific about that. So there certainly was, in the wake of the 2008 meltdown, a sense that the system was out of control, that it was unduly dangerous. When we clearly saw what happened, to all those jobs and the economy as a whole globally, and that there was a series of voices that spoke out that said there would have to be changes. It would have to be akin to what happened after the Great Depression, when we did get a sort of generation of financial regulation and controls. That hasn't happened. And it sounds like what you're saying is that that's because the president didn't really want it.
Well, yes, I think financial regulation is where it's the emblem of the Obama leadership failures, because for that very reason, that the crisis is the crisis. So you can understand that there's a panic, there's a terrible fire, they have to put it out. I think they made mistakes there, but those mistakes are somewhat understandable. But then the panic subsides through 2009, and then you have an opportunity to radically reshape the financial system and the regulatory architecture. This is something that you do with forethought. You have time to think about it. And the times called for something dramatic. It was necessary to do something big and dramatic to overhaul this out-of-control system. But they don't get it. They don't do it. In fact, even Geithner thinks pre-crisis, he says, we have a terrible financial regulatory system. It is balkanized. There are competing interests. The regulators are captured. So he acknowledges the problem. And internally, there are people who acknowledge the problem while they're debating this. But in the end, they only push for something that is really pretty piecemeal, an incremental improvement over the regulation that we had before. It's extremely disappointing. The only conclusion you can draw is that Obama's Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, Obama's Federal Reserve, Obama's SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, Obama's CFTC, and Obama's FDIC are all working together to come up with something that is ultimately disappointing. And that strikes me as Obama's responsibility.
At the president, we're here right now, he might well look you in the eye and say, you know, Jesse, that's just not fair. You look at what's happening in Washington, the polarization, the division, the Republicans controlling the House. I got everything I could. You're making a very politically naive argument. What would you say to that?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that they compete in the Obama administration to be the one who bows the longest and the deepest to political reality. I am the most realistic about our limitations. But I think that they significantly misread the political moment of 2009, where, in fact, the pressures were pulling them in the opposite direction, pulling them to the left for more radical changes to the financial system. First of all, you get someone like Blanche Lincoln, the senator from Arkansas, who's facing a challenger from the left, a progressive challenger, and she's trying to shore up her credentials and pushes a more radical derivatives regulation than the Obama administration wants. And instead of embracing that, reading that as the politics of the moment, they push back against her. Second is that Russ Feingold, this liberal, quixotic, difficult senator from Wisconsin, is also holding out on financial reform from the left. So they just sort of abandon him completely and instead try to woo Scott Brown. But they're wooing Scott Brown because he wants to embrace financial reform. He understands the political reality of being a senator from Massachusetts. So there is a lot of pressure from the left. The other thing is that the Tea Party rises up with great anger toward the big banks. And that would be something that could be harnessed or that there's a coalition to be made. One of the senators who is one of the biggest critics of the big banks is David Vitter from Louisiana, a very right-wing conservative. So I think there was a coalition that they botched.
Now, continuing to channel Obama just for a moment, I might well, if I were him, say to you, but Jesse, that rant, the famous rant on CNBC that started the Tea Party movement, was about the fact that the government appeared poised, perhaps, to bail out homeowners and that this was completely unfair, that those guys who'd bought an extra bathroom and an expensive house were going to get government help and the people who were frugal weren't. And, you know, that lit the flame of the whole thing. So if that's true, was it populist opposition to the banks or anger that somebody was going to get something they didn't deserve?
Well, that was a thornier political problem. And I agree that there was some legitimate sensitivity. I think that the Tea Party has a terrible conflation of anger at the stimulus, anger at the bailout, anger at some sense of homeowners getting bailed out, three discrete things. But there were certain things that the Obama administration could have done that are completely, wholly inexplicable. And one of them is the refinancing program, where they had taken over Fannie and Freddie. They could have refinanced underwater homeowners who were current on their mortgages, who were paying above prevailing mortgage rates. So they weren't giving anybody a gift. They were just going to bring them down to the prevailing rates that anyone in the private market with good credit could get.
And we should point out that they weren't doing – the reason those homeowners themselves weren't doing it is the market was pretty well frozen.
Right. The market was frozen, and inexplicably Fannie and Freddie were – they were sort of excluded from their credit box. So for some reason they were blocked, but it wasn't because they had – a legitimate reason for not being allowed to pay the prevailing rates. They were current on their mortgages and paying a lot of money. And this would have benefited the homeowners. It would have stimulated the economy. It would have helped other home values in the neighborhoods where these people were getting mortgages. And Geithner reveals that his math on this program was completely off the Treasury's math by an order of magnitude. And economists from Chicago have demonstrated this very clearly, that the math was off.
Meaning that the cost of the government was much less than people thought
exactly,
it might be.
And or that, more importantly, that the benefit from this was to the economy was much less than it really would have been. And that is an inexplicable failure. And it would not have been politically costly, or you would have made it up because the economy would have been recovering so much.
Let's look ahead for just a moment. So the financial reform story is still a story in progress. Do you see any prospect that the sort of direction of things could change in the next 2 years?
You know, I think it's stumbling toward this kind of middling modest success that's ultimately very disappointing with tinkering around the edges. So they've gotten a little bit more capital into the banks than might have been expected 2 years ago. The Volcker Rule was modestly stronger ultimately.
And you should explain the Volcker Rule for
our listeners. The Volcker Rule is the rule that says if you take deposits and those deposits are backed by the federal government, as deposits are, then you can't go speculating with that money in the markets trying to win by gambling, because the taxpayer takes the loss. You get the gain and the taxpayer, the loss is socialized. And so the Volcker Rule says no speculation with that kind for your own institution's profits, and bans that. And the question was whether there were going to be giant loopholes that were going to render the rule meaningless. And the loopholes actually were tightened up. One big question now is that the Federal Reserve is operating with several open seats. And the Obama administration has shown very little interest in nominating appointees. Now, the nominations have been fought, and it's been a fraught process, and I can understand how wary they are putting up nominees, but they should put some up. And when they do so, if you wanted to consolidate your accomplishment in financial reform, you'd put up a financial reformer. The Fed is the biggest, most important regulator of the financial system. It also happens to do monetary policy, which is also important, but it's not the sole function of the Fed. So, you know, if they put a reformer in, it would be a big signal to people that they took this seriously.
Jesse Eisinger, thank you very much.
Thank you.